I'd just like to say first, I've been at Sussex for quite a long time now, and it's been, in general, although difficulties at times, of course, a wonderful time. It's a hard place to leave. The environment's beautiful. I've enormously enjoyed the students I've taught over the years. One of my very first years is here tonight, and some of this year's first years are also here. And of course, second years and third years too. And I've also really enjoyed the companionship of lots of colleagues in all disciplines and in all parts of the university, but of course, particularly my colleagues in philosophy, who couldn't find a nicer group of people or a more interesting set of philosophers, and it's been wonderful working these years here. Anyway, today, you don't want to hear me saying things like that. I'm just going to try and do some philosophy today at a level that I hope that will be reasonably engaging. Philosophy, I think, is ultimately about meaning. It is provoked originally by questions about the meanings of things, and it issues in the end in questions about the meanings of things. And in between, it deals with some other questions that don't seem to relate directly to questions about the meanings of things, but they do. And most of our time is spent in that middle ground, and we look at those questions in a very distinctive way, in great detail, patiently, sometimes repetitively, unflinchingly, and occasionally with some humour. Now, what I want to do today is to look at a single argument. It's an argument that has, I think, a huge currency across the whole culture, starting really from the time of Galileo, perhaps you could date it earlier. And it has a kind of grip on the whole culture, both among the sciences and among the arts. And my aim today is to look at that in a bit of patient detail, as rigorously as I can, to try to understand a bit how it works, and to offer a way of defusing it and making the world as it is in itself a little bit more amenable. I would be very surprised if you end up agreeing with me. In fact, I'd be very disappointed if that's so. Those who've heard me lecture before know that I expect really people to be upset by what I say. Well, perhaps that won't happen today, but I expect people not to agree, but I hope that we will have spent an hour doing some philosophy, and that will be fun. So, the world as it is in itself. The first question is what's the world? And if you ask that question, the first thing you think of is something like that, a globe. And so this, the world as it is in itself, would then be a lecture in the very purest form of global studies. But actually, that's altogether wrong. The world, as we think of it in philosophy, is not the Earth. It's not what a globe represents. It's really the counterpart to a certain kind of relationship. A relationship that you find when someone thinks about something, when someone talks about something, when someone perhaps depicts something in a painting, or I think, not everybody else does, when they compose music about something. It's the other side of all those abouts. Now, if you call those sorts of things, talking, thinking, depicting, composing music about, let's just introduce a general term. We'll call them types of concern, in a special new technical sense. Then the world is just that to which anything which can concern us, in that sense, belongs, and of which anything which can concern us is a part. And that belonging relation and that part relation, those are actually rather difficult, and I'm not going to go anywhere near there, but just start with that for the minute. That's a kind of definition. But it's a very special kind of definition. I want to make a quick contrast between two different sorts of definition. What I'll call an identifying definition, which just merely isolates something as the topic of the conversation, and what I'd like to call a natural definition, which reveals the nature of the thing. And here's a nice picture, I hope you think. this, what I wanted was a picture of a woman with a fedora hat. And I'm afraid I couldn't find a nice picture of a woman with a fedora hat. So I've got Alida Valli with a hat that's a bit like of a fedora hat, but it's okay, right. Anyway, if you use the phrase, the woman with a fedora hat, that helps to identify the woman, but it doesn't tell you anything much about her nature, okay? Unless perhaps she's a fictional woman. And as it happens, in fact, the fedora hat comes from a princess fedora in a play of that name. So, in fact, well, there we are. Okay. In the same way, I think, that definition I gave of the world is a merely identifying definition. It fixes the topic. But it absolutely, according to me, can't be part of the nature of the world that it's that to which anything which can concern us belongs. Because we're concerned with the world, the things we are concerned with, precisely because they are independent of that concern. And that's the issue. Now, you might worry about that. Well, what sense is it in which the world, if it includes everything we can think about, talk about, write about, paint, in what sense is all that really independent of our concern? And the problem is raised by a series of things, like ourselves, our own thoughts, and most obviously artifacts. Because it looks as if these things are not altogether independent of our concern. We shape our own destinies by thinking about ourselves. We shape our own thoughts by thinking what to think. And we shape artifacts by deciding what to do. So it looks as if those aren't going to be independent of our concern. Well, I think it's a small problem, and I'm going to produce a technical solution and a technical term to solve it. Okay, suppose someone were to say that things other than these, other than ourselves, not thoughts, not artifacts, suppose someone were to say that some other things were dependent in some way on the way we think about them or upon the possibility of our thinking about them or representing them. Think here of mountains or rocks or hills or the sea, things like that, things that are not in any obvious way shaped by human activity, right? Think of those. Now, suppose someone were to say that things like that were in some sense defined by, shaped by, determined by the ways we could think about them, the ways we could represent them. That'll be a special kind of dependence that those things have. There'll be a way in which, as it were, our thinking or representing or the possibility of that will affect them, but without our doing any further action. Okay? And that'll be a special kind of dependence, which I'm going to call concern dependence. Just that special sort. I'm not sure there is any such thing, but there are people who think there is. Okay? So we'll move on from there. So that's the thought. You can deal with that. Let's concentrate just on this special kind of dependence, concern dependence. And that allows us to formulate three grand positions in metaphysics about the relationship between the world and our thoughts or representations of it. First is a realist. That's a technical philosophical term, so not realist as in realist painting or anything like that. A realist is a philosopher who thinks that things in general are concern independent of us and of any representation that we might have. An idealist holds conversely that they're concern dependent upon us. There's some sense in which they're defined by the kinds of interest we might have in them. And then there's a cautious anti-realist who's just unwilling to accept that they're really concern independent of us. And any of these positions might be held either about the world as a whole, everything that we can think about, or about just some feature of it. And a popular choice among philosophers here is colour as a thing that is thought to be, in some sense, dependent upon the possibility of sight or of perception or something like that. Well, my aim in general, of which today's talk is only a little bit, is to defend a kind of absolute realism. Okay? Nothing is ever concern dependent on us or on any representation of it. Okay. That's the long-term goal, but I'm going to deal today with a particular argument which I hope you find enjoyable. Now, if you've got that contrast between realisms and idealisms, that'll enable you to say what the world as it is in itself is. The world as it is in itself is the world as it is, altogether concerned independently of us, unshaped by anything to do with our own interests or anything like that. So to believe in the world as it is in itself is to believe in a kind of realism. Well, there is a certain innocent view, rude people call it naive. There is a certain innocent view that we ordinarily, that means all the time, every day, now, are in touch with the world as it is in itself. That we're ordinarily in touch with a world that is altogether concerned, independent of us. And they're right. But that's cheating a bit. You need to find that out later. Right. Okay. Okay. Now, there's a long history of worries about that. Do we ever see the world as it is in itself? And I've got a couple of pictures here of famous alumni of rival institutions. On the left is John Locke from Oxford. Following on the tradition of set by Galileo and more nearly Boyle, made a strong contrast between what he called primary and what he called secondary qualities. And the key thing about secondary qualities for Locke is that the conception of that we have of them, our ideas of them, as he put it, did not portray them as they are. So he thinks that, for example, when we look at the colour of something, the colour that we're aware of, we think it is of a certain character, but really it's not. Really all there is a bunch of very small footballs in the world, okay? But we mistakenly see it as colour. Okay, that's the Locke view, right? The man on the right is from Caltech. That's Richard Feynman, one of the greatest physicists of the 20th century. There's a lovely sequence of little interviews between him and Christopher Sykes, which you can find on the BBC archive. They're called Fun to Imagine. And in the first one of those, as a way of sort of explaining his scientific credo, he says, nothing's really as it seems. Nothing's really as it seems. And that's exactly the same view, okay? There's a worry. The thought is that some things that we see, they aren't really in the world as they seem to us. In the world, things are a certain way, and the thought is normally that the physicist will tell us how they are, but we mistakenly think they're otherwise. So the way that things look to us, appear to us, is different from the way they really are. Okay? That's the view of both Locke and Feynman, and an awful lot of people in between. And it's generalized in a very dramatic way by this man, whose home university I think no longer exists, but there's a new one named after him in the same city. This is Kant. I'm not going to pretend to any kind of Kant scholarship, but the argument that I'm going to be concerned with is, I think, Kant's argument. I'm going to suggest that. Kant scholars dispute quite a lot about exactly what he had in mind, and I'm not going to engage in that. What I'm going to look at is a very simple, intuitive argument, which I think is in the spirit of Kant. And then we'll see that if you carry it on a bit, you get beyond Kant into something altogether more dangerous. So, that's the argument. A Kantian argument, I say. And it has three premises. And a nice little so at the end of the third to tell you that the conclusion is going to follow, and so indeed it does. The first premise is we can only see the world as it appears to us. And the point of that is to say roughly that our engagement with the world is always accompanied by various things that we bring to it. Most obviously, of course, the actual mechanism of our senses, but also every kind of cognitive predisposition we might have, whether you might think that that was innate or whether it was brought up in a culture or what, okay? That's the first thought. We can only see the world as it appears to us, with what we bring to it. Okay? Then the second premise. If we can only see the world as it appears to us, we cannot see it as it is in itself. I just talked about seeing there, but what applies to seeing, it seems, applies quite generally. So if we can't see the world as it is in itself, it looks as if we can't have any knowledge at all of the world as it is in itself. And that is the Kantian conclusion, that we can't have any knowledge of the world as it is in itself. Now, that's where Kant stopped, roughly. But you might carry on. So starting an argument with the conclusion of the previous one, just say, okay, let's accept that we can't have any knowledge of the world as it is in itself. Well, then think about this. If you can't have any knowledge of the world as it is in itself, can you even think about the world as it is in itself? Can you talk about it? Can you describe it? Can you pick it out in any way? Natural to think you can't. And that's what this premise K5 there says. If we cannot have any knowledge of the world as it is in itself, the world as it is in itself can't be an object of our concern, of any of those kinds of attitudes. And then if the world as it is in itself can't be an object of our concern, well, there's something problematic now about the very phrase, the world as it is in itself. How's that going to work? It's supposed to refer to the world as it is in itself, but that, it seems, can't be an object of our concern. So it looks as if we end up with this view at the end, that there's no such thing as the world as it is in itself. Okay? And I take it that Kant denied the second of those steps, the K5 there. But again, I'm not a scholar, so I'm not going to chase that. And what happens? That's right. Now that conclusion, I think, is disastrous. The conclusion is that there is no such thing as the world as it is in itself. That conclusion is disastrous. It looks as if we end up only being able to think and talk about a world which is in some way or other concern dependent on us. But now reflect how this all started. It started with the idea that we can only see the world as it appears to us. But then think about that, to us. It looks as if various specific features of our particular cognitive constitution are going to make a difference, are going to shape the way things seem. So it's then going to be hard to see how you could think or talk about anything which dogs, which we might suppose to have a rather different cognitive or perceptual constitution, might be concerned with. And that looks as if it's going to be a bit of a puzzle. You don't want to say initially that you can't talk about what the dogs are interested in. Well, there's a simple and traditional response. You can try being rude about dogs, okay? You just say they can't really think at all. So they can't really be concerned with anything. So they don't really have a world. So it's all right, okay? But then that doesn't look really right, because you just say, well, what if there were a sort of super being, vastly more intelligent than us, vastly more rational, much more articulate, much more thoughtful, okay, totally different cognitive constitution. We won't be able to, as it were, get onto that being's world either. But it's going to be silly to just cling proudly to our own little world and be content with that in those circumstances. Because it looks as if it'll be hard to claim that our world, our little world, is the world. So that's a first worry that I think lots of people have about that conclusion. And here's a sort of purer, more philosophical version of the same kind of thing. Because the way the argument works is by beginning by supposing that we can make intelligible a contrast between, on the one hand, the world as it appears to us, and on the other, the world as it is in itself. But by the end, the world as it is in itself seems to have been placed beyond what we could possibly describe. So it looks as if by the end of the argument, we can't make any more sense of the contrast which the argument began with. Okay? And this is a rather unsatisfying position, because We feel we've made a great philosophical advance by getting to the end of that argument there, but the advance seems to consist in nothing but denying that it could be an advance, roughly. There's nothing there. And that's a familiar tangle that you'll find, for example, at the very end of Wittgenstein's Tractatus, the last remark of Wittgenstein's Tractatus, where he says, for pretty much this kind of reason, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. And that's what I call the Basil Fawlty approach to German idealism. Don't mention the world as it is in itself, and hope you can get by that way. Well, I think that's utterly unsatisfactory, obviously. I also think that the second part of the argument is good. I think once you've got to K4, you have to go right on through. And you can't go right on through, so you better stop the earlier part. So let's have a look at it again. And this, the key point is just to look and see how this argument works. There's something bewitching about this argument, and the question is try to work out what's going on with it. And I'm going to offer at least a provisional diagnosis today. So it starts with that thought that we can only see the world as it appears to us. We then say, if we can only see the world as it appears to us, we can't see the world as it is in itself. What applies to seeing applies generally, so we can't have any knowledge of the world as it is in itself, and that's where we are. Okay, now I did think quite carefully about whether to include that, but there we are. Right, the real challenge, of course, is K2, the second premise of that argument. It's the core. You want to know why we should believe that. Here's a very simple argument for it. Again, it's all very, very simple, the steps. It's trying to see whereabouts something odd has happened. So it looks as if you might think, well, if we can only see the world as it appears to us, we can only see the world as it is in itself, if it appears to us as it is in itself, right? And then it looks as if you might say, well, the world can't appear to us as it is in itself, and so that's how you get the result, K2, that if we can only see the world as it appears to us, we can't see it as it is in itself. Right, well, the thing that looks most obviously worrying to a person like me is K2B, the claim that the world cannot appear to us as it is in itself. What it's meant to oppose is what I called earlier the innocent view, a certain innocent view about perception, and perhaps particularly about sight. It is quite interesting that sight always comes to mind first, and I'm going to make a remark about that later, but it's mostly sight, I think, that people have in mind, but start with that and think of it generalizing. Well, on the innocent view, the view that it's supposed that pre-philosophically we're all likely to have, our senses are, as it were, transparent. And that's a metaphor you keep coming across all across the literature. The innocent view holds that our senses are transparent. We simply take in through them the world as it is in itself. And since this is supposed to generalize, I take it that the innocent view will hold that that supposedly happens for anything you might do, any mode of knowledge, basically any mode of description, and so on. But remember K1, which reminds us that our perceptual and cognitive constitution is always involved in some way in perception. And the problem is that it's hard to see how our perceptual and cognitive constitution could be involved at all without making a difference. And surely it can't make a difference of any kind without making a difference to the way things appear to us. And that's, it seems, what the innocent view forgets. And what K2B, remember, that's it, the world cannot appear to us as it is in itself, what it says, in effect, is that the process of perception is bound to transform the way things appear to us. According to this view, the innocent view supposes that the way things look at the end of the process of perception is just the same as the way they look at the beginning. And that seems a fantastic hope. And it's sort of demonstrated in the simplest possible way by a little diagram from a how to have fun with science or something thing here. This is constructing a little lens thing. You've got a candle casting an image on a box at the back. And you can see, even in this very simple case, there has been a change from the beginning of the process to the end. The candle's turned upside down. So there we are. There's some change. It would be astonishing if there were none. That's very crudely the thought, okay? So that's our problem. K1 introduces the involvement of our own perceptual and cognitive constitution. K2 says that that prevents our seeing the world as it stands independently of that involvement. And since the point is entirely general, apparently, K3, generalize it. And that goes to all knowledge, and we end up stuck at K4. Okay. So the task is to try to see what's gone wrong there. And I think that that's been a challenge for everybody who takes this kind of argument seriously. But for an awful lot of really the whole intellectual world, the conclusion is, I think, accepted. You could hear it more or less being accepted, or a move to a very long way towards it, accepted by Feynman in what I reported earlier. Well, I think the decisive move in this argument is carried by two metaphors. The first is the metaphor of transparency, and the second is the metaphor of representation. The innocent view, remember, is said to hold that perception, and indeed in the end all knowledge, is transparent. And then once we acknowledge the existence of a process of representation, this is something that the innocent view is, of course, supposed to forget, to hold that perception is still transparent then is to hold that what appears at the end of the perceptual process is the same as what you had at the beginning. And that's where you get a kind of representation in, and that's why the little picture with the candle is right. You get a form of representation etymologically understood. What was there at the beginning of the process has to be imagined as being presented again, the very same thing, presented again at the end. And that's something there. By the time we got to the end, we've got something for which the metaphor of transparency is clearly appropriate, because now we're at the end, there isn't a further process to mess it up. Okay. Now, what I'm going to do is to press on the use there of the notion of the metaphor of representation, because I think you can get at least part of what's worrying about the argument by considering the way that works. The whole problem, well, maybe that's too much, at least a good part of the problem, I think, is created by whatever it is that makes it tempting to think of perception in general and knowledge altogether in terms of representation. And actually, you can construct a version of the argument, a version of the problem anyway, just using representation, if you conceive it in a certain way. So I'm going to look at that, and we'll see if we can a way of attacking that. That'll get a way of attacking the general problem about perception and knowledge, and then I'll finally try and say something about how to get rid of the metaphor of representation itself. What gets this going is a certain ideal, an ideal of transparent representation. Again, the metaphor of transparency is naturally used in the case of representation, just as it is in the case of perception. Putting it very simply, the ideals captured in that thought are. It just says that the function of representation is just to present an object. That's what it does. What representation does is just gives you the object. There are various ways in which you might do that, because the object, of course, itself won't be present. It might do it by calling the object to mind, getting you to imagine it, anything you like. But the function of it is just to get the object to you. Now, suppose you think, as we are all inclined to think, that a representation, you might think here of a painting or a verbal description, represents something in the real world, and really real, the world as it is, altogether concerned independently of representation. If that's what it does, then any feature of the representational medium is going to be at best a distraction. And then what it'll do will be to interfere with the function of representation. If you notice the medium at all, that'll be distracting from the business of getting the object to, okay? Well, is that a plausible way of thinking of the medium of representation. And we've had enough words, so here's a picture. This is, I've never seen it in the paint. It's by Rembrandt, it's The Prodigal Son. It's in the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. And it's arguably the greatest painting in the world, he says. Right? Okay. It's an absolutely wonderful painting. Now, you can't look at this for a moment without noticing the way it's painted. And you can look in some detail there. You can't really see it very well, I'm afraid, there. But this is a thing you see in one or two other Rembrandt paintings. There's a curious way in which the hands sort of stick on the back of the sun. The old man's hands stick on the back of the sun. And if you put that together, they sort of stick, but sort of don't quite stick. If you put that together with a sort of very static upright composition, you get a kind of massive gentleness in the touch of the hands there. Okay, you can't look at that seriously without noticing that kind of thing. And it obviously just is all about the way the thing is painted, both in the detail of the application of the paint and in the composition. You can't look at that without that. Well, it's a bit odd to think that those things I've just remarked are distraction in some way from what's really supposed to be going on here. And just so you don't think I only look at paintings, here's a very famous speech from the beginning of Othello, in which Othello says that he's not much of a speaker. There he says in the middle there, "Rude am I in my speech, and little blessed with the soft phrase of peace." But, okay, so other people can read that better than mine. And what he's going to do is say, "Yet by your gracious patience, I will a round, unvarnished tale deliver of my whole course of love." Well, this is a representation of a plain soldier who's not much of a speaker, really. Okay, and is the poetry a distraction? I think not. If you think the poetry is a distraction, there you've made a major error. In fact, I'll go so far as to say. The results are absurd. It's absurd to think that the thick paint in Rembrandt is a distraction from the view of real human flesh you might think you could get without it, and absurd to think that the fine poetry of Othello's speech is a distraction from the insight into the character of a plain soldier, which might otherwise be made available. Now, that was what the problem you got. If you held on to the idea of transparency in representation, the idea that the function of representation is just to get the object to you, if you held on to that ideal and also thought that what a representation does is represent something in the real world. Okay? So you might think the smart move here was to drop the real world bit and move into a kind of other view, and you end up with a form of idealism. What will happen is that Rembrandt's paint will end up representing not real hands, but, roughly speaking, hands reconfigured for paint. And Shakespeare's lines will end up representing not a real plain soldier, but a plain soldier sort of reconfigured for blank verse. And that may sound a very odd thing to say, but it is, I think, far too often said. And it's said an awful lot in a very particular case, the case of language, where it is often supposed, uncritically and almost all the time, that words have to attach to some kind of reality that is conceptualized and therefore of the right shape for language. And that's the result of holding on to the ideal of transparent representation in the case of language. But now, if you add to that something akin to noticing that the paint rather matters in the Rembrandt, or the verse rather matters in the Shakespeare, you notice that a description written in English, it sort of matters that it's written in English. And that's a bit different from a description written in French. And if you think about reading a book in either language, or a poetry or anything like that in either language, it's pretty odd to think that the fact that they're in this language is just a distraction, and the peculiarities of this language are just a distraction from what's going on. And if you follow the same policy here, you end up not being able to say that the French and the English describe the same world. And although you might want to be rude about the French, you can't play the dog trick there, okay? And you also have the other problem as well, exactly the same problem as the Wittgenstein problem. You won't be able to describe in English the limitation of the English world to English without inadvertently transcending the limitation and in effect contradicting yourself. And so you get back in a different way to Basil Fawlty. And those both arise, just in the case of representation, by insisting on the ideal of transparency in the case of representation. So the obvious thing is to deny that ideal of transparency, say that it's not the business of representation just to represent an object. Whatever you say, it's going to be a bit complicated, you have to allow room for a distinction between these two things. The first thing, W1, is, roughly speaking, the way a representation represents something as being. So the paint on the Rembrandt, it represents the hands as being the hands of an old man, say, right? And W2, the way in which the representation represents it as being the way it is, and that is by thickish paint, okay? And the first one is a feature of the object, of the world, and the second one is a feature of the representation, of the medium, okay? And basically, the medium's business is to represent the world in a certain way. And that's both representing the world as being a certain way and using the medium in a certain way to do it, okay? And there's no reason at all why the world, which is represented in the first way, should be completely concerned, should not be completely concerned independent of representation. It's just the world, just ordinary skin and stuff, like everything else. And there you are, and that's surely what it is. Okay, now the thing to do now, I think, is try to adapt that solution, the first thing to do anyway, to the case of perception and more knowledge more generally. So you need a distinction within appearing, as opposed to representation, which is parallel between W1 and W2, which of course you've got on your song sheets, so you're finding it hard to follow. So here's a thought. You contrast first the way something appears as being. For example, if I look at the carpet, it appears sort of flecky, okay? Right? And then there's the way in which it appears as being as it is. And that'll be something to do with the way my perceptual system engages with it. So the first one is a feature of the object, and the second one is a feature of the whole perceptual situation, including all my perceptual and cognitive constitution. And there's no reason yet why the first one shouldn't be as concern independent of perception as you like. Nothing wrong with that at all. Now, that distinction is not always apparent in perception. It's not always evident in sight, for example, it seems to me. There's some aspects of what's seen which obviously do draw on that, I think, although more complicated than I can quickly run out. But it's not obvious that our sense of colour, for example, presents colour to us in a way that makes us aware both of the colour which is being presented to us and of the manner in which we're doing. And that's perhaps why sight is always the sense that is to the fore here. We're always looking at sight. Colour is everyone's first example of a concern-dependent feature of the world, and transparency, of course, is a metaphor to do with light, what sight is concerned with. But it is sometimes apparent, even in ordinary perception. Most obviously in touch. When I feel the texture of something, this feels sort of slightly sticky but slightly smooth, okay? I'm simultaneously both aware of the texture, slightly sticky, slightly smooth, as a feature of the object, which it has quite independent of any concern with it, and at the same time I'm inevitably aware of my own body engaging with it. I can't touch something without that, okay? So I have clearly present both the feature, the way the texture of the thing appears as having, the A1 thing, and the way my body takes it, okay? Both at the same time. Well, now, let's look back at the key argument. Here was the, the key thing, okay? If we can only see the world as it appears to us, we can only see the world as it is in itself. If it appears to us as it is in itself, the world can't appear to us as it is in itself, we're told. So we can only, if we can only see the world as it appears to us, we can't see it as it is in itself. And the key thing is to work out how we are to understand that phrase as it appears to us here. Well, the point of the phrase in the original argument, all the way back, was to point out that our perception, our own perceptual and cognitive makeup, is always involved whenever we look at anything, whenever we know anything, or anything like that. So that should be the AW2 reading. That one, right? Okay. And if you slot that reading in, you get these two versions, roughly, of 2K2A. You've got a verbatim one on your handout there, but it just gets a bit complicated reading it all out. Just to see if you can get it. If we can only see the world by perceiving it, then we can only see the world as it is in itself, if our perceiving it, that's the AW2 thing, is altogether independent of our perceptual and cognitive constitution. But of course, our perceiving the world can't be altogether independent of our perceptual and cognitive constitution. So away we go. Well, that second one is obviously true, as expected, because that's what it was set up for. But the first one is false. The fact that we can't see things without our perceptual or cognitive constitution being involved has no tendency to show that what we see, the object of our perception, is in any way shaped by or defined by our perceptual or cognitive constitution. So let's try the other reading. If we want to sense a credible constraint on what we see, we want the other reading, the feature of the object reading, okay? The way the object is, for example, the carpet flecky, okay? Well, then we get, if we can only see the world in the way it appears to us as being flecky, we can only see the world as it is in itself, if the way it appears to us as being flecky is the way it is in itself. And then the second premise is, the way the world appears to us, flecky, cannot be the way it is in itself. Well, the first one is true, but the second is just false. It is flecky in itself. That's it. That's what the carpet's like. Right. Or so I claim. But there will be people worried even about that. Okay. So we've got to try to tackle that. How can I claim that's false? Or conversely, how can I claim that T there is true? T. I put T, but just so you know, it's the truth, okay? Okay. The way the world appears to us as being is the way it is in itself. Of course, not when you're suffering from some illusion or hallucination, but ordinarily, okay? The way the world appears to us as being is the way it is in itself. Now, the problem with that, if you find that difficult, as the tradition I think generally has, my suggestion is that the difficulty is whatever it is that makes you think that perception and knowledge involve representation. Now, in real representation, you have before us always two things. I mean, in the first instance, you have the representation, maybe a painting, okay, on the one hand, and what's represented. And you can see both, representation, what's represented. And there's a little picture where you can see both, so it's all right, okay? But when we're not under an illusion, when you're not hallucinating, there are not two things here at all. There's just the one thing. Just, I think, the way the world is in itself. And that one thing, happily, when you're not suffering from illusion, is apparent to you. So, here's the puzzle. Representation requires you to think of two things, but in perception, there's only the one, okay? So why should we be tempted to think there are two things? Why should we think that the way the world appears to us could be different from the way it really is in itself? Well, here's the thought, I think. Only because we think we could if we were God. For example, I say for example, actually, but there's not many other candidates, to be honest. Compare one with the other. It is as if you might get at the world independently of sight, and then you might compare the way it looks with that. the way it really is, okay? But of course, if you are going to get at the world independently of sight, you're going to get at it by some other means. And that other means will be another means. And that other means will be a way of perceiving just as much as sight is, and will depend upon our, or God's, perceptual and cognitive constitution just as much as sight does. And that other way of perceiving, that other main means of getting the thing, will have no special authority by which it can undermine the claim of sight to reveal the way the world is in itself. It cannot show that sight does not reveal things as they are in themselves. Well, we only think that this other mode of access, the God's mode of access, has a special authority if we forget that it must be a means of perception, the very thing I've just been labouring. That is, we can only think that the way the world appears to us as being could be other than the way it is in itself if we accept the assumption which the innocent view was mocked for holding earlier, if we hold that view which was called naive, okay? That is, if we think there could be, in principle, even to God, access to the world which was strictly transparent, a kind of perception which involved no perceptual faculty. So that's the mistake, I suggest. And that's the idea which makes us think, in the end, that all perception and knowledge must involve representation. And it's also the very same idea as what makes us want representation to be transparent. And if we drop it, we can devote ourselves, as artists must, and philosophers are artists of a sort, to representing the world as it is in itself, entirely independent in every way of representation. And when we walk in the sun, tomorrow, we can be confident that the ground on which our shadows are cast is not itself another shadow.